Welcome to the Summer of Peace, a free global online event designed to help you find inner peace and to take inspired action. The Summer of Peace is a production of the Shift Network, and this Global Compassion Summit is co-produced with Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, as well as the Charter for Compassion. The Global Compassion Summit highlights the latest science and practices that help us embrace compassion and recognize compassionate action as an important path to peace. We're so grateful that you're here. Please share your questions or insights at www.facebook.com/shiftnetwork. And now, your host for this call, Emily Hein, the director of the Global Compassion Summit.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for dedicating some of your time to compassion today. My name is Emily Hein, and it's my honor to be your host for the Global Compassion Summit. It's extremely humbling for me to introduce our guest this hour, Thubten Jinpa. Thubten Jinpa is a former Tibetan monk with the Geshe Larim degree, and this is a Tibetan Buddhist academic degree and the equivalent of a doctorate degree in divinity, for those of you who don't know. Jinpa also holds a BA in philosophy and a PhD in religious studies from Cambridge University. He taught at Ganden Monastery and worked as a research fellow in Eastern religions at Girton College, Cambridge University. Some of you might recognize Jinpa as the principal English translator to His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He's been of service to His Holiness since 1985 and has translated and edited numerous books by the Dalai Lama. His own publications include Essential Mind Training and translations of major Tibetan works featured in the Library of Tibetan Classics series. He is the main author of Compassion Cultivation Training, which is an 8-week formal program developed at the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education at Stanford University. His most recent book, I can tell you, is extraordinary. It's called A Fearless Heart, How the Courage to be Compassionate Can Transform Our Lives. Jinpa is an adjunct professor at the Faculty of Religious Studies at McGill University in Montreal. He's the founder and president of the Institute of Tibetan Classics, and he's the chairman of Mind and Life Institute. Jinpa lives in Montreal and is married with 2 teenage daughters, which is reason enough to be an expert in compassion. What an honor to have you with us today. Welcome, Thubten Jinpa.
Thank you for having me on your show. Thank you.
It's our privilege to have you here today. You're such a wonderful expert in the field of compassion, which we know is evolving and expanding. And so what we'd like to do for our listeners today with you is kind of start out with, you know, the definition of compassion. Many people might think that they know what compassion is, but you provide a really beautiful formal definition. And what is that?
Yes, you are right, Emily. You know, a lot of people, when they think about compassion, many people feel as if they know it. It's a bit like happiness. You know, when we think about happiness, we kind of feel we know it. But if you try to understand it and define it, it becomes kind of difficult and elusive. So it's helpful at the beginning to try to have a greater clarity about what we mean by compassion. Compassion I actually define in the following. I understand it to be part of our natural impulse. So it's essentially a natural sense of concern in the face of someone else's pain or need. And that sense of concern is accompanied with the wish to see the relief of that situation, and may sometimes also be accompanied by wanting to do something about it. So there is, first of all, a kind of a perception of someone suffering and understanding it. There's an empathetic or emotional connection with that need or pain. And then there is this kind of a motivational component, which has to do with the wanting to see the relief or resolution of that problem.
I really appreciate that you bring in, you know, first of all, the perception of it, which speaks, of course, to the importance of mindfulness and compassion, which we'll get to later. But I know that a common question that comes right on the tails of compassion is, how does it differ from empathy?
Empathy is more of an emotional response that we feel in the face of someone's pain. And it's a kind of a very instinctive, natural response. And the reason why empathy is such a powerful emotion is that empathy relates to the, particularly when it, empathy arises in response to a situation of pain in someone else. Pain is a very powerful connector, acute suffering in front of us that immediately connects with our own experience. So empathy can be a kind of a feeling with, which is kind of a resonating the other person's experience, or feeling for, which is not necessarily mirroring the other person's experience of pain, but actually feeling a sense of concern for that other person. So empathy is really more very strongly emotional in its quality, whereas compassion is quite different. Compassion does arise through the route of empathy, and it has a very strong emotional component, but compassion has this added dimension of a wish, wanting to see the relief and, you know, resolution of that situation. So, you know, one could say that when you're in an empathetic state, the focus is really on the pain and the suffering. And when you are in a compassionate state, triggered by that, you know, perception of suffering, your focus is now less on the problem, but more on what can be done. So, you know, they may seem like the same thing, but compassion is in some sense more evolved state, and it has got a more complex dimension because there is this motivational component that is part of the compassion. And they arise, they're very instantaneous. You know, one feel empathy arising in the face of a suffering, we emotionally connect, and then compassion can arise naturally. So you don't really have to wait.
Right, right. This is a little bit of a divergent, but I think it's worth noting almost that there's some a difference in the kind of male-female version of suffering and problem-solving. And as you speak to the difference of empathy and compassion, my sense is, and correct me if you think I'm wrong here, that sometimes in dynamics, male-female dynamics, women like to spend a little bit more time in empathy before going to compassion, i.e. ending the suffering.
Yes.
And
yes.
I've noticed that men like to go right to, you know, what's the solution? And
exactly.
Both have value, but
sure.
But just like
sure.
Dabble a moment in empathy before you go to solving the problem. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, generally, there are research that shows that although there is a debate on whether or not there is a difference in the level of empathy between, you know, men and women, but clearly common sense suggests that because women have maternal instincts, so one would expect probably empathy to be more stronger in women. But the research isn't that clear on this, but you are right. Men generally immediately like to see the solution, but sometimes that urge to seek out the solution is not necessarily related to a kind of a moving from compassion, empathy to compassion. It's really, in the case of men, often it has to do with some kind of intolerance towards suffering, whereas women generally tend to be more patient with relation to suffering. So men's impulse to immediately solve the problem may not necessarily come from empathy moving on to compassion. So it may have more to do with the kind of the aversion towards suffering and wanting to just solve the situation immediately. And this is where, and in some cases, that kind of response is not particularly helpful because a genuine compassionate response to a suffering does require a degree of patience. And in some situations, there may not be a solution as such. And so the simple understanding and acceptance and kind of, empathetic in expression of your solidarity with that person who is suffering may be the most compassionate thing to do. So it's more complex than suggesting that men moves from compassion, empathy to compassion directly. I think it's more complex than that.
as our male-female relationships, but thank you for taking a moment to entertain kind of an important topic for a lot of people. Let's kind of switch gears from kind of that definition of compassion and empathy to the benefits of compassion. I know there are many.
Yes, actually, one of the very interesting things that are coming out of contemporary research on the new science of empathy and compassion is that actually how beneficial compassion is for the individual himself or herself. Because in most traditional societies, as well as contemporary societies, and there is a kind of a widespread recognition of compassion as being important value. But most of us generally tend to think of compassion as a kind of a moral value that is good for others, and it is good to be compassionate. But very rarely we actually think about compassion as being good to ourselves. So compassion is really seen as a moral value that, kind of help influence the way in which we, ethically treat others. But now the research is increasingly pointing out that actually the main beneficiary of compassion is really the individual himself or herself. So we are beginning to see how compassion is in fact a key to one's own personal well-being, that when we are able to express our compassionate nature and respond to situations of our own problem as well as that of others from compassion rather than negative excessive judgment, we are less stressed. And also when we are able to act out of compassion towards someone's need, we're able to feel much more alive as a human being. And we feel deep sense of connection with others. And this deeper sense of connection with others is a powerful buffer against any problem of, potential loneliness, which is, again, a major, issue in contemporary society. And also, paradoxically, research is showing that actually if people are able to express their compassionate nature more, freely and relate to others out of kindness and have a more open-hearted kind of attitude to others, and kind of a resilience, arises in the person's mind, which then allows the person to be able to deal with his own problem and difficulties in a much more constructive and courageous way. So even from the point of view of dealing with stress, being compassionate again offers us a kind of a buffer against being overwhelmed. And that's kind of paradox, because common sense would suggest that because compassion involves, taking concern of others' problems, that we might actually be more distressed, because in addition to our own problem, we are taking on someone else's problem. But the effect seems to be the exact opposite. The more we are able to open our heart and, leave space for others in our heart, the more resilient and we become, which then allows us to deal with our own situations in a much more efficient way. So all of these are very interesting research findings that are showing that, and in my book I actually have a whole section called Compassion as the Best Kept Secret of Happiness.
I appreciate that you mentioned all of that, because you mentioned, first of all, the deeper connection with others, how that can be an antidote to loneliness, which is a major issue that leads to depression. So compassion, I'm generalizing here, can be a tremendous antidote to many of our own personal issues that we might have that bring on our own suffering. And
yes,
as you said,
yes.
It's almost counterintuitive that when one is suffering to then, perhaps be of service to others. But the research is showing that it's quite beneficial and increases our resilience.
Yes, and also one of the important things about compassion is that when you are able to act out of kindness to someone, you feel useful. You feel a sense of purpose. And again, many of the new science research on happiness is pointing out that one of the most important ingredients for genuine happiness is to have a greater sense of purpose. And again, here, compassion, allowing our compassionate nature to express in our interaction with others is really the most efficient way of, having a greater sense of purpose in one's life. So those, you know, all of these really suggest that, you know, compassion, you know, being able to live from that part of our nature really holds the key to personal well-being.
Beautiful. Beautiful. From your book, Jinpa, A Fearless Heart, the subtitle is How the Courage to Be Compassionate Can Transform Our Lives. Why do you think it takes courage to be compassionate?
Well, I think the reason why I chose to really use that term courage in the title is really to really make an important point, because you know, although compassion is part of our natural impulse, we are all kind of gifted by it. You know, it's not something that you have to learn at school, or you know, you have to learn in a temple. But we often don't live from that part of our nature. We often don't allow that part of our nature to be expressed, because we bring resistance to, you know, expressing our compassionate nature. And some of that resistance may be culturally acquired because of the highly competitive nature of society, and also, you know, often in contemporary society, Western society, subconsciously we are brought into this powerful narrative of human nature, that somehow ultimately we are all self-seeking creatures, and you know, the ultimate explanation for human nature really lies in the pursuit of self-interest. So we become suspicious of other people's compassion as well as our own. So we bring resistance. And also, in Western kind of, you know, thinking, there's a long tradition of kind of, you know, drawing a dichotomy between emotions on the one hand and reason and rationality on the other. And somehow there's this idea that you know, we must apply our rationality to rein in our emotions. Otherwise, you know, we will be out of control. And since compassion is really seen as belonging to the emotions camp rather than the rationality camp, people worry that if we allow our kinder part to be expressed more freely, we may lose our rationality and we may not be able to cope. And then also people worry that if we are too compassionate, other people may take advantage of us. They may see us as weak and pushovers and so on. So we bring all sorts of resistance so that we do not allow our compassionate nature to be expressed, whether in relationship to our own self. You know, sometimes we are the harshest critic of ourselves, or in relation to dealing with other people, you know, people who are important in our lives, at workplace, and also in larger societies. So I think this is why we need a kind of a conscious intention to bring compassion into our life. And we also need to have a kind of a courage, because to be compassionate really involves having the courage to kind of open our heart, and also be, you know, accepting of the possibility of rejection. Because when you open your heart and reach out to someone and extend your hand, there is no guarantee that that extended hand is going to be received. So, but being compassionate, you know, requires that kind of courage to be able to allow ourselves, so that, you know, even if someone does not accept our extended hand, we should be able to understand it. But also compassion brings courage. So I think there is a, you know, very close connection between courage and compassion.
Wonderfully said. And I also appreciate kind of the nuance of the importance of self-compassion in this whole process. In particular, you know, as you talk about having the courage to open our hearts, be vulnerable, potentially reach out our hand in hopes that someone will respond. And if they don't, we have to come back to self-compassion and self-soothing.
Yeah.
This seems like a good point for us to talk about one of the things that you have been so instrumental in bringing to the world. You were the main author of the Stanford Compassion Cultivation Training Program. And I'm wondering if, for the benefit of our listeners, you could walk us through the main elements of the program and kind of why you designed it the way you did. And I know you had input from other esteemed colleagues, but from your perspective, you know, what are the elements at the high level, and why was it designed the way that it was?
Well, thank you for asking that question. And you are familiar with the Stanford program, so and you know, as you mentioned, that it was a collaborative work, although I was the main author. But the main inspiration for developing that program was really the kind of the looking at the amazing story of the mindfulness movement and how kind of a contemplative practice based approach to mental training, such as in the form of mindfulness, have really made an amazing offering that is beneficial to the larger world, and where some kind of spirituality and mental training could be brought within the secular domain without any complications of religiosity, which often makes people kind of, you know, uncomfortable and suspicious. So in the end, if you look at mental training such as mindfulness cultivation, essentially we are talking about some form of cultivation of qualities that are already there within the human mind. And with mindfulness, one of the main effects of mindfulness is the offering us the ability to calm our mind and also learn to consciously pay attention, and then also offer us the skill to be able to disengage when necessary. Because often much of our problem arises from over-identification of what's going on in our life, particularly in the emotional domain. And also, a lot of that over-identification is really tied up with believing in the contents of our thought too much. And mindfulness training has enabled a lot of people to be able to really adopt a much more kind of detached stance towards our own thoughts and the content of those thoughts, so that we learn to disengage. So if that is the case, then I felt that bringing in another type of contemplative practices, which now taps into the emotion side of our brain, whereas mindfulness taps more into the cognitive side of the brain, and the compassion training, taps more into the affective or emotion side of the brain. And so there is a tremendous potential to be, gained by bringing a well-thought-out, systematically developed adaptation of, contemplative practice that are aimed at cultivating our compassionate kind of heart and mind. So that was basically the motivation. And then the question is, how do we do it in a way that is, that makes sense? And there's a kind of a natural order and sequence in the traditional, say for example, the Tibetan Buddhist contemplative practice on compassion cultivation, which was one of the main basis of my training that I developed. So we begin with the basic mindfulness type kind of quieting the mind practices, which is really kind of a ABC of meditation. And once we have gone through that step of learning to quieten our mind, learn to focus a little bit, and develop a greater sense of self-awareness so that we can observe our thoughts, emotions, and so on. After that, then we begin with evoking a sense of loving kindness that we naturally feel for our loved one. And the beauty of compassion and loving kindness is that, unlike mindfulness, loving kindness and compassion are natural qualities that we actually have. You know, all of us know what it feels like to be kind to someone, to love someone. So the step involves being more aware of that part of our emotion and response, and then using kind of somatic experiences as well, and doing some visualization. And once we have learned to recognize what that feels like of a loving kindness experience, then the next step is self-compassion, where now we are turning this or directing this to our own situation and our own selves. And we do that by turning to first and do a genuine self-forgiveness and self-acceptance, and followed by kind of a loving kindness towards oneself, where the main focus is really to feel comfortable at the gut level that you can wish for your own happiness, and learning to distinguish between kind of, you know, self-absorption and genuine self-kindness. So that those are the two steps, and which then once you have developed that, then we learn to expand the scope of that loving kindness and compassion towards others by first thinking about a neutral person, then thinking about a difficult person, and then thinking about all human beings. And there the key step really is to cultivate what we call kind of genuine recognition of common humanity, and that, you know, an ability to connect with other people at the basic level of humanity, where what defines us as human beings is the natural aspiration to be happy and natural aspiration to want to avoid suffering. And there, on that level, there is no difference between others and myself. So we use phrases like, just like me, he or she too wishes to be happy. He or she too does not want to suffer. So that is a very important step, and we call it common humanity practice. And once you are able to establish that recognition of common humanity, you then have a basis to make the connection with the other person, and then generating a genuine compassion for other person becomes easier. So this is how the steps unfold. Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for outlining that. I have benefited greatly from the program, both by being a student of CCT and then by taking the teacher training program and becoming a certified teacher of it. And I can attest that being on both sides of it, both as a student and as a facilitator, there are many, many benefits to kind of this 8-step CCT program. One of the elements of this, as you know, is mindfulness, because you mentioned it at the very beginning with great detail, and I think that's so important. And as you know, it's becoming more and more mainstream in Western cultures. Can you speak to those who might be listening to this program a little bit more about how do you get into mindfulness as a practice, let's say, if you weren't to take CCT? And I'm going to tee you up a little bit here, a little bit more thoroughly here, Jhumpa. Specifically, when you were speaking to Jack Kornfield at Spirit Rock, you used an analogy regarding mindfulness and skiing. I don't know if you remember that, but perhaps you could tell the story of how developing a mindfulness practice, you know, might be a bit like learning how to ski. Do you remember what you're speaking of?
Yes, yeah. And the point I was trying to make is that, you know, mindfulness is something that we actually have to cultivate. It's not, you know, there was a big paper that came out from Harvard, which did a study of, you know, thousands of people using kind of, you know, apps, you know, and people were pinged on, you know, kind of randomly and asked what they were doing at that very moment and, you know, whether their mind was wandering or not. And based on that study, a paper was published which said that the human mind is a wandering mind, and wandering mind is a source of problem, source of suffering. So it turns out that almost 50% of the time, even when we are supposed to be working on something, our mind is wandering. So, and so mindfulness is something that we need to cultivate. It's a skill that we have to develop. And the basis is there in us, but it's not, you know, it's something that we have to learn. It's a bit like skiing, you know. But once you have, initially, you know, when you are learning it, it's a very effortful activity. You know, those who have learned how to ski knows very well. And often, the difficulty at the beginning really comes from our instinctive, you know, sense to want to control and resist. But those who have learned ski knows that once you're able to be more relaxed and let go and be more fluid, you know, the learning is much easier. The same thing with mindfulness. So initially it's an effortful activity, but then over time it becomes, you know, less and less effortful. And then you get to a point where you will be able to observe without feeling the urge to control and you know, overly identify with the thoughts that are happening in your mind.
Right. So the important point is, as you said, there's a tipping point. And just like learning any new skill, you know, it can be awkward at first. It can be very awkward putting on the boots and you know, all the gear so you're not too cold and strapping on these long, you know, boards. It just, you know, feels awkward and uncomfortable and out of control. And then eventually there's a time when you start to enjoy it. I want to also ask you to elaborate a little bit on the intersection of the compassion cultivation training and nonviolent communication. That's been an important element of learning for many people who are interested in peace and compassion. Would you mind just speaking a little bit to that?
Yes, thank you for asking that question, because when I was working on the compassion cultivation training, although the Tibetan compassion meditation was the primary source, and also the Tibetan mind training instructions, which are really a resource, a tremendous resource, like a jewel, but I also wanted to make sure that as much as possible I could adapt techniques and insights that are coming from the contemporary, kind of more Western approaches. And, you know, I've been an admirer of, you know, Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication for quite a while. And one of the things that I have really been deeply impressed about the NVC approach is the distinction that is drawn in NVC. And because NVC is, you know, ostensibly, it's about a question of language, you know, and the reason why, there's a reason why it's called communication. It's, and in fact, I think Marshall Rosenberg uses the subtitle for one of his books, Language of Compassion. So one of the powerful aspects of that approach is learning to distinguish between language of just simple observation of facts that are happening in front of you or in your life or in your relationship with others, and language of evaluation and judgment, which we bring. Now, it's easier said than done, you know, because if we think about the way in which we talk about our experience and our observation of the world around us, you know, quite often our language is shot through and through with our judgments. And this technique that my NVC teaches us to make a distinction between observation and judgment language is a powerful way of kind of, you know, getting at the root of how biased our perceptions are of the world. And as much, and because the approach is language based, it's much more interactive and active. So it, in, for some people, that approach is more effective than a quiet, formal, reflective sitting. So, and I think, so we have tried to use that as an important point, because in the end, genuine compassionate response to either to one's own situation or others is the ability to bring a total non-judgment and acceptance and kindness to the situation. And we, unless we have kind of a quite a high degree of self-awareness of where and how we bring judgment into our perception of the world, we're never going to be able to avoid from, you know, negatively judging. And some of these judgments may be quite subtle. We may not know it, but essentially it's about biases. So, and the other thing that NVC that is very powerful is NVC emphasizes the need to have a greater emotional literacy so that we're able to have a high degree of self-awareness so that we know, and a lot of that is again language-based. We learn to name the subtleties of the different emotions that we experience, and then these feelings or emotions, feelings as they are called in NVC language, and the basic ones are then correlated to what in NVC language is called the basic needs. And needs are universal, and basic feelings are universal. And so, and the needs, you know, in kind of plain English, one could say that these are basic aspirations of human beings. You know, everybody wants to be happy, everybody wants to be safe, everybody wants to be included, everybody wants a sense of belonging. You know, so all of these are, you know, in NVC language referred to as needs, but they are basic human aspirations. And connecting, you know, feelings, and particularly the more destructive ones, with needs that have been unmet or violated, is again a powerful approach to make us understand a situation better and respond to it out of compassion. For example, if someone loses a temper and shouts at you, and if you are able to understand that that explosion of emotion is coming from a pain in that person, where there's a sense of frustration of something or a disappointment, then the chances of you responding to that kind of, you know, emotional outburst with compassion is going to be much greater than if you don't understand that that kind of emotional explosion is coming out of a pain. So I think NVC insights, when they are combined with the compassion training, you have a powerful mix.
I completely agree, and I'm so grateful that you brought up all these nuances and how NVC and compassion cultivation training work so beautifully together. One of the phrases that I picked up from taking the nonviolent communication training is, as you say, when somebody expresses themselves in anger, Marshall Rosenberg uses the term, it's a tragic expression of an unmet need.
Yes, that's a
And I love that term because, oh gosh, oh, you poor thing, you're having a tragic expression of an unmet need. Well, now I can come to you from a feeling of compassion versus defensiveness. I haven't
exactly
done anything wrong.
Exactly.
You
exactly
have a need that's unmet. How can I help you meet that need?
Exactly.
The other piece I think is so beautifully woven together is you mentioned how biased we are in our perceptions of the world. This is really where common humanity comes in so beautifully, recognizing, you know, you want to speak, could you speak just a little bit more about common humanity and in the face of that judgment?
I think the idea of common humanity is in some sense very simple, you know, and it's almost, you know, to the point of being kind of rather banal, you know, so what's the big deal kind of thing. But often what happens is that we actually don't, we only pay a lip service, and we don't, you know, I mean, it's not, you know, to really have the impact on our behavior and, you know, on our thought and emotion, the recognition of common humanity has to be really at the gut level. It's not just an intellectual kind of assent to that proposition. One has to really feel it at the gut level. And the reason why, for example, like, you know, we feel more empathy towards someone who is close to us is because we are able to connect with that person at the common humanity level very easily. And if, for example, the opposite is when we make distinctions between us and them. Say, for example, like in tribal societies, you have a very strong sense of tribal identity. So there's a kind of in-group where you care for everybody within that community. And then you have an enemy, which is an out-group, to, you know, members of whom, to whom then you don't, you know, allow your recognition of common humanity to actually express. So you have that very sharp kind of dichotomy of us versus them. And in those kind of situations, you cannot feel concern or empathy for the other side because you refuse to recognize the common humanity at the gut level.
Mm-hmm.
So if we are able to really, you know, establish this sense of connection based on recognition of common humanity at a very deep level with anyone, then compassion becomes quite natural. You know, it really allows us. I mean, one of the reasons why, you know, when a total stranger is bleeding and screaming in front of us, we immediately connect and rush out to help is because that experience of pain in front of us immediately connects with our common humanity. And that connection and identification allows us to feel a sense of concern and reach out. But in other cases, you know, sometimes we have to work hard to recognize that common humanity, which then gives us the ability to connect with that person and identify with that person. To feel compassion to really genuinely have compassion for someone requires recognition of that basic humanity as a kind of a minimum condition. This does not mean that you have to like the person. You know, therefore you can actually feel compassion for someone who God as your enemy, someone who has been nasty towards you, someone who wishes you ill will, who wishes you ill. But while recognizing that that person is your enemy, but you can still feel compassion for that person because the compassion is directed to this basic human level. So I think often people confuse because people think that when someone like His Holiness says that you have to feel compassion for everybody, people sometimes think that what he's suggesting is that you have to like everybody.
Right, right. And I think the phrase that you brought up earlier and is so pivotal is the just like me. You know,
yes.
If you think about an out-group, for example, somebody who's in prison, you might not find an immediate connection to them, but just like me, that person is somebody's son or daughter, sister or brother, mother, father, and just like me is such a connecting phrase, no matter what. So,
yeah.
Well, let's
there is
go ahead.
You know, I mean, it reminds me of a beautiful film that I saw, quite a while ago. It's called Wings of Desire. It's a German film, it's a story of two angels, who kind of hover around and sit on top of kind of churches, and then one of the beautiful scenes, and the memorable scenes, is that one of the angels, gets very inspired by how humans live and the pain and the depth of the pain and suffering that humans experience, and so starts kind of listening to the internal chatter of different people. There's an amazing scene in a library where you can actually hear the thoughts of different people going on, and begins to the angel begins to really recognize that how this ability to recognize what other people are thinking but not being able to have an emotional connection really makes him feel kind of alienated. So he really wanted to experience, and then he chooses to stop being an angel and take a human form and become mortal. So basically, to make a connection with someone, it's not adequate simply to know that the other person wishes to be happy, but actually you have to feel it. You have to emotionally connect with that part of that, human reality.
What was the name of the film again, Jinpa?
Wings of Desire. That's the English name. It's a German movie, quite a while ago.
Good. Okay, good. That sounds really great. Hey, we have just a few minutes left, and so I want to take us up to the 40,000-foot level here. You've worked with the Dalai Lama since 1985, and he, of course, has really been a global icon for compassion. And then, of course, you yourself have studied compassion and authored this very impressive compassion training protocol for the benefit of our world. Do you think the time has come for a compassion tipping point in our world?
I think so. And the reason for saying that is because there are many forces coming together. One is that that our global reality today is such that, people from different backgrounds, religion, culture, language, ethnicity, are increasingly being brought together, where we have to live our life on a day-to-day basis by interacting with people from a completely different background. So in this, it's a cliche, but the world is really a village now. And in this reality, increasingly, our ability to accept and tolerate differences is going to be a key challenge. So a genuine peaceful coexistence where we develop an ability to respect other people in exactly as ourselves is going to be key. So that, I think, is basically a question of necessity. If we are going to survive as species in this 21st century, some kind of recognition of common humanity has to be part of the larger cultural ethos. That's obvious. The second thing is that, you know, science is a powerful force in defining our ideology of the way we see the world. And up until very recently, the predominant ideology of human nature has been this selfish interest, kind of self-interest and selfish nature kind of thing, story. But now this is changing with the, you know, new discoveries coming from the empathy research, non-human primates research, and so on. So even in the science and evolutionary theory, people are already beginning to question, you know, this kind of narrowness of defining human nature purely in self-interest terms. So there is a movement towards finding a more robust way of understanding where, how and where compassion fits in within our picture of who we are as a species. So, and then furthermore, thanks to, you know, new findings in contemplative science as well as neuroscience, people are beginning to recognize actually living from compassion as part of our nature is good for each of us. And everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to have a more enriched, meaningful life. And, you know, living from that part of our nature is really going to be the key. And now contemplative science also shows that we can do something about this. Each of us can, in some sense, exercise our compassion muscle so that compassion need not be just left as an ideal, but actually it could be made as part of everyday reality. And in the end, you know, it's kind of paradoxical or strange, but the ultimate argument really is self-interest argument, because anyone who chooses to live their life from more from that compassionate place stands to gain in his or her life. That really is the bottom line, and that is increasingly becoming clear. And as these insights and knowledge becomes more widespread, I think, you know, just as mindfulness took on, you know, on a kind of a societal level scale, I think compassion and its cultivation will also take on.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. And this leads us to our last question, which is really looking at those who are listening to this today, this interview, and those who will listen to the recording. All of these individuals have a rare opportunity to be inspired by your words, and we have a rare opportunity to inspire them. So do you have any final messages or suggestions for our listeners about how they might kind of exercise their compassion muscles to create more compassion in their own lives?
Thank you. I would actually say that, you know, I mean, of course, there are systematic compassion cultivation practices that if people are inclined, they can try them out. And I have presented some of these in my book, but also there are now many CCT instructors like yourself who are offering the courses in different parts of the country. So people can attend those classes, which are, I think, would be the most effective way. But for most people who do not have the time or the inclination to follow that kind of more systematic approach, I would suggest two things. One is to pay conscious attention as much as possible to see where and how compassion figures in their own personal life. Each one of us, as a moral creature, we have a value system, whether or not they are fully articulate, but each of us have a value system that guides our how we live. And the question is, you know, where does compassion fit in that hierarchy of values that, you know, govern our lives? The second is to really make an effort as much as possible to make compassion part of our conscious intention. You know, with motivation, it's very difficult to shape it directly because motivations often are not very conscious to the person himself or herself. But intentions are conscious, and we can choose to have different kind of intentions in different kind of situations. And the more we are able to bring compassion as part of our conscious intention in the way in which we live our life, treat our loved ones, treat our friends and, you know, colleagues at work, and relate to the world, the more we stand to gain, and also the more we will feel connected and deeper sense of belonging and greater sense of purpose. So I think those are the two things that I would suggest. Pay conscious attention to compassion in your life and make compassion part of your conscious intention in your everyday life.
That is great advice. You are very inspiring, Jinpa, and I want to say that on behalf of all who have benefited from your personal and professional efforts, myself included, thank you for using your generous heart, your focused mind, your time, and your conscious intention to contribute so valuably to compassion and compassion education. Thank you so much for being of service to our world in this very remarkable way.
Well, thank you for inviting me on this very important, you know, Global Compassion Summit. And, you know, looking at the list of speakers, that guest speakers that you have lined up, it's a very impressive set of people. And I hope that, you know, those who will participate in these courses and listen to these, you know, conversations will really, you know, find something that will be beneficial that they can use, you know, immediately in their life. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And for those of you who would like to get further information about Jinpa's work, there are two websites that I can recommend. One is mindandlife.org, and the other is ccare.stanford.edu. And I'll send these out in the summary emails, but the Stanford site will give you a link to the 8-week compassion cultivation training if you feel inspired to take that, or to find a CCT teacher near you. Or if you'd like a wonderful read on compassion, I highly recommend Jinpa's latest book, A Fearless Heart. In addition to core compassion lessons, he really interweaves beautiful stories of his own personal life, including working for His Holiness and transitioning from a monastic lifestyle while continuing to be of great service to the world. So thank you all for listening to this wonderful, comprehensive talk with Thupten Jinpa, and please join us for the next session of the Global Compassion Summit.
Thank you for joining us for the Summer of Peace, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community dedicated to helping people awaken to their divine humanity and take inspired action, visit theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the Summer of Peace and the World Peace Library, visit summerofpeace.net. Thank you for sharing this summit with your friends and family. We appreciate your dedicated support.